This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Today, the clock starts running on a 49-hour-long fundraising campaign for the University of Alaska. Joining us now is Catherine Portelli, Development Officer, as well as Annual Fund Manager. Welcome, Catherine.
Hi there. Great to be here.
Thanks for being here. Tell us about UA Giving Day and why it's actually 2 days plus 1 hour.
Yeah, it's a little bit unique. This is a event that a lot of American universities are doing these days. So this is our second annual event. And we spread it across 2 days, I think because it's not just one school. This is a statewide event for all of the University of Alaska campuses. So we're collaborating with the people over at UAA and UAF and all the community campuses to make this work. We're calling it 49 hours for the 49th state.
What is the need for Giving Day?
Yeah, in university development, we try to raise private support to sort of keep the rising cost of education from being transferred directly to students. Mm-hmm. So in this event, if you take a look at the website at givingday.alaska.edu, you'll see that we've chosen a variety of sort of high priority causes or funds or projects. So on the UAS site, we have about 28 of those. And when donors give to those funds, the gifts are only used for those causes. So it's not a budget that can be, you know, cut or changed. It's only going to be used for student scholarships or, you know, for a certain academic program.
And how successful was it the last time you did this?
It was great, especially because that was our first ever year doing it, and it was 2020, and a lot of things had to change at the last minute. But pulling up our results from last year, we statewide have brought in about $670,000, and we had a nice round number of 1,111 donors. And for UAS, that brought in about 150 donors and $72,000. And really, this year, we're mostly trying to focus on participation, not dollars. So it would be great if we raised $1 million for UAS. But what I would really like to see is the number of people who are interested in supporting UAS go up.
Well, what are some of the ways that you can give, especially if we want to support UA Giving Day, but we don't have a lot of money to donate?
Yeah, that's kind of a focus of this event, too. So it's based on sort of crowdfunding principles, sort of like GoFundMe or Giving Tuesday, where the amount is not really the focus. It's more like, you know, the power of working together to get things done. So if you have $5 to give, that's going to move the needle. We're really looking for participation. And trying to band together to sort of achieve these larger goals. Yeah. And if you really, if you'd like to give and help in a non-monetary way, or if giving is not really on the table for you, there's another way to help out. If you go to the Giving Day website, which again is givingday.alaska.edu, at the top, you'll see a tab called Champions. And that's a sign-up function where you can sort of, you'll get resources and instructions to sort of spread the word. And when you sign up for that Champions function, you're also entered into a statewide drawing where you can win 2 first-class round-trip Alaska Airlines tickets. It's a statewide drawing, and I would really like to see someone from Southeast Alaska win those tickets.
What is the social media element of UA Giving Day?
Well, just like a lot of crowdfunding campaigns, if it picks up on social media, it can really start rolling quicker and quicker. So we try to sort of bolster that. We've got a social media aggregator on the site that's sort of picking up what people post. So if you post something, and I encourage you to, it's I think that there's just so much eye candy around the communities that UAS is in, that it's simple to just post a picture of your favorite UAS spot or memory and then add the hashtag 49 hours for Alaska, and it will be picked up on our social media aggregator. And social media just in general, it's just a good way to let people know that this is happening. Yeah.
Did you say hashtag 49 hours for Alaska?
Yep, that's right. 49 hours for Alaska.
That's great. And just a reminder to everybody that this has already kicked off. And so the clock is counting down, and there's 49 hours from the start to finish. I know there's not.
Yeah, so I should be clear. Yeah, it ends at Wednesday. It ends tomorrow at midnight. So jump in now. There's still lots of time. Ends tomorrow at midnight.
And you're with UAS, University of Alaska Southeast, but all the campuses in Alaska are participating. Do you know how each location is trying to make this their own?
Yeah, so we've all been working together. I've been meeting with people at UAA and UAF, as well as communicating with you know, leaders at UAS, Sitka, and Ketchikan. You know, everybody has their own priorities. I would say that UAA and UAF have sort of each done their own spin on it. UAA has decided to gamify things a lot, for example, by including lots of interesting little matches and challenges. If you take a look at the site, you'll see there's lots of like little ways that you can make your gift go further. So for example, the Juno Suicide Prevention Coalition has provided a match up to $2,500. So all gifts to their suicide prevention fund at UAS, which is used to fund mental health initiatives to help UAS students, will be matched by them. And there's a couple like that. So there's a match for the food pantry. There's a match for all scholarships funded by Wassman and Associates here in Juneau. So UAA kind of ran with that idea. And UAF is focusing a lot on sort of telling student stories. If you browse through their site, they've got lots of great quotes and photos showcasing their programs. UAS, we sort of went with focusing on students for sure. And this year we're showcasing our community campuses a little bit more as well. We've also got the UAS Student Government Fund in there up for fundraising, which I think is really great because UAS Student Government is a really active group that does their own philanthropy on campus. They support student scholarships and prizes on campus.
Well, thanks for all that information. If we do want to follow along on social media with all the posts and the hashtags, are you on all the different platforms, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter?
Oh, yeah. I think that our Instagram is my favorite. So that is UA Southeast, simply. I think it's the same across all of our platforms. And yeah, I would get in there and start posting. If you've got like a favorite UAS memory, just share it and tag it 49 Hours for Alaska, and you can sort of join in the fun.
That's great. And I know that you said the monetary, the dollar amount is not necessarily the focus that you really hope for engagement. Mm-hmm. Do you have a goal that you're trying to hit in on one of those levels?
No, you know, we had a lot of discussion about it and we decided that we really don't. We're looking for participation. You know, if we have 10 times as many people give this year, but they all give less money than they did last year, that's still a huge win. We would really like this event to be sort of an approachable way for people to consider supporting their university. Not everyone can start their own scholarship. A lot of people can support an existing scholarship.
Well, again, givingday.alaska.edu is the website. 49 Hours for Alaska is the hashtag on social media. I'm speaking with Catherine Portelli, Development Officer and Annual Fund Manager. And Giving Day is underway. So is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners before we say goodbye today?
I would recommend that you go to givingday.alaska.edu and sign up for that champions, at that champions option and win those tickets. Somebody needs to win those tickets.
Well, thanks again so much for speaking with me today, Catherine Portelli, and lots of luck with Giving Day this year.
Thanks so much.
Take care. Have a great afternoon.
You as well.
I'm Shelley Delaney, and from motorcycles to beaded necklaces and earrings to pottery and paintings, there's lots to bid on, and it's all for a good cause. Joining us now to talk about an upcoming bazaar, which has gone virtual, is Carol Burrill, President for the Community of Christian Women's Bazaar. Hi, Carol.
Hello.
And Jane Ginter, the auction coordinator. Hello, Jane. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much to both of you for being here, giving me an excuse to play some Christmas music a little bit early at the end of the interview. Fair warning, everyone. But Carol, before we get into the details of the bazaar, tell me a little bit about the Community of Christian Women, the organization that you head up.
The Community of Christian Women is a group of just basically any woman who goes to Northern Light United Church. And our church is a combination of United Methodist Women and Presbyterian Women USA. So rather than highlight any particular denomination, we just call ourselves the Community of Christian Women. We meet at least several times a year, but our big event is the bazaar every year. We've been able to do this for basically several decades, and it, because of COVID, we've had to go virtual, and it has worked very well last year, so we're hoping for a big year this year.
I understand that the proceeds of this bazaar will support the Northern Light United Church's programs for women and children. Can you say a little more about that?
Yes, I will. For example, we have given money to AWARE here in Juneau. Also, we've paid the fees for kids to go to camp here out at the Methodist camp. For example, one year we did kids whose folks are incarcerated and may not have a chance to go to a camp. So we've paid their fees so that they could do that. Each of the denominations, Methodist women and Presbyterian women, have projects that we have funded as well that are probably worldwide. We've given money to the Glory Hall so that they could get going. The Juno Reentry Coalition Family Room, we put money to them last year so that they could open and have room for families to come and visit the folks that have just recently come out of jail and got into the community. We've given money locally to Klingit and Haida Youth Shelter. That was one of the things that we did last year. Up in Anchorage, there's a group called Alaska Child and Family, and we've given money to those folks for a long time. And they take care of kids from all over the state of Alaska and bring them into a sheltered area in Anchorage that's supportive and help them whatever needs they have. So those are just some examples.
Great. And turning to you now, Jane, you're the auction coordinator. How many of these have you been a part of over the years?
Well, I've helped a lot with the auction that we've had in, not the auction, but the bazaar that we've had in person. But last year, when we realized that we couldn't have it in person, we turned to an online auction. And so that was our first year, and I helped with that. And then I'm helping again this year. Last year, we had, I believe, 279 items that we were auctioning. And this year, we have over 400.
Wow. So what's it been like to go virtual? Can you say more about that? Has it been more work, less work, same amount, more effective, less effective?
Well, it's a lot more work trying to put it all together. But what's worked out well is that we can emphasize certain items that we have and let people know about that. So we have some very, very nice pottery items, and we have some nice posters, and we have some excellent artwork. We've had lots and lots of donations. We even have some antique tools, and so those have been really fun for people to take a look at. Things like that might have gotten lost before when we had the bazaar in person, so people are able to read in more detail about the items that we have for sale.
And could I mention, please, Shelley, that this year we're dedicating the bazaar to Grace Akiyama. Grace and Dr. Henry Akiyama were longtime members of Northern Light United Church, and they've both passed away. But their son, Alan, who lives here in town, has had a whole bunch of his folks' things. And specifically this year, he had so much yarn that was his mother's. Someone mentioned that maybe she never passed by a sale. So one of the big items that's on our list this year is a whole bunch of yarn. And in the past year, she's given lots of Christmas items that they didn't need anymore. So we're dedicating it this year to Grace Akiyama, and several folks in the community will know who that is.
Mm. Can you say more about what made you want to honor her with this dedication?
I think probably it's just the fact that the family has been so generous in going through everything that the family, that Henry and Grace left, the amount of support that we've had in the past when we weren't a virtual bazaar was just, you know, tables loaded with Christmas items. There was candles, there was decorations, there was artwork. It was amazing how much she had over the years, probably decorating her husband's office and then also at home. And then this year with all the yarn, we were overwhelmed with the amount of yarn. So there's still plenty of good yarn left to purchase.
I was looking at the bazaar, the offerings online a little bit earlier today, and the items really run the gamut. I saw two motorcycles, also a secondhand pottery wheel and kiln, along with the antique tools that you mentioned, and numerous handcrafted items from jewelry to macrame to artwork. Do either of you have a favorite thing, something that's caught your eye so far, something that you would bid on yourself if you wanted to, if you could? Jane, I'll start with you.
Well, I'll tell you, my husband has fallen in love with a little bowl that is made out of pottery that's shaped like a duck, and it holds a quart. And he thinks this would be the perfect thing to have on the counter for maybe cracking some eggs in for making scrambled eggs. So he and another person in Wrangell are in a bidding war right now. And this was started off at a $15 beginning price, and they have now bid it up to $200. So this is my husband, and he is going crazy. So, but what catches my eye are the bowls that are made by Don Gottschall. Don Gottschall is a wood turner, and he has some of the most beautiful bowls that you can possibly imagine. And so I actually have bid on one of those for myself, and we still have quite a few that haven't been sold yet. So I'd recommend that people look at these gorgeous bowls.
Thanks, Jane. And Carol, what about you? What are some of your favorite items up for bid?
Well, there's a pair of earrings that I really like, and I'm not sure if I'm going to keep bidding on them because I'm not sure if it's as high as I'd like to go, but some very pretty earrings with a little green stone and then some silver dangly things. It's very pretty. Plus, there's a pie that Betsy Brenneman makes, a scrumptious pecan bourbon chocolate pie that is, as they say, to die for, and it is very good, and that's something that I might just have to have.
Well, I want to mention that the online bazaar did already begin. It opened on October 31st, and it closes pretty soon on November 13th, and the website is nlunorthernlightunitedchurch.org/bazaar. I want to thank you both for your time today, for coming on and telling us all about the bazaar and also about Grace Akiyama, to whom it's dedicated. And I thank you both for all of your hard work to make it available on a virtual platform. And I'm also really pleased to hear that so many people are bidding and driving up the prices of these items. So I hope that you will really make all the money that you want, that you need for these programs for the women and children. So I just want to give you a chance to add anything that I might not have asked you about so far. Jane, do you have anything you'd like to add before we say goodbye?
Well, we have lots of pies and breads and cinnamon rolls and things like that that you might just want to bid on, so you can have those to eat both for after the bazaar and maybe even for Thanksgiving.
And Carol, how about you?
And last year we noticed that there were some people who signed on late in the day and really bought a whole lot of stuff. So if there's something that you got your eye on, don't wait, because somebody else is out there looking at that stuff too.
Oh, I wanted to
thank you.
Yeah, sorry, one last detail to clarify. If we do win an item in the bazaar, in the bidding, what happens then? We pick it up from you?
Go ahead,
yes,
Jane.
We're going to have on Saturday, November 20th, which would have been our normal bazaar time if we had been in person, we will have the items at the church, and people can come by and pick them up. And because we're still maintaining social distancing, we'll just have you come to the main door at the church, and then we will bring your items to you.
From 9 a.m. to 2 p.m.
And where can we find out more information or ask questions?
On our website, and you can just take a look at our Northern Light United Church website. And if you don't remember the link, you can just type in news and then bazaar, and you'll find the link there.
Wonderful. Again, thank you both so much. Jane Ginter, Carol Burrill, thanks for all the work that you did in putting this together. And I think it sounds like a lot of fun. I hope people go online and check it out. Appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Shelley.
Thank you so much.
Take care and have a great afternoon. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. This month, Southeast Senior Services is offering a series of lectures to help families provide care for their loved ones. This week's presenter is Laura Wayman, who has been pushing for innovation in dementia care. Hello, Laura, and welcome. Coming to us from hot Arizona.
Yes, I am coming to you from hot Arizona, and thank you so much. I'm very honored to be here and share my message.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us. And also here is Denny Darby, a family caregiver support advocate for Southeast Senior Services. Hi, Denny.
Hey, how are you?
Good. You were here with us last week. How did your first session of the series go?
It went really well. You know, I think we worked all the bugs out. It was it was a great way to tee off the rest of the series. So I think, you know, we're excited to have Laura with us tomorrow. And, you know, we had a lot of viewers, a lot of really great feedback. And throughout the week, I've had more people asking how to get to the recorded sessions. So I think it's going to be, it's been a great success.
All right. Well, we'll go over the details about that a little bit later. But Laura, let's start with you. You're the author of a book called A Loving Approach to Dementia Care. What made you want to write this book?
Well, let me tell you a real quick story. So I am a gerontologist by trade. So I really have enjoyed very much over my adult lifetime learning about ways to age healthy. But I want to tell you a story of a caregiver by the name of Peggy. So many, many years ago, Jack and Peggy, Peggy was a young girl. She was 18. Jack and Peggy eloped. They had a wonderful family life. They had five healthy children of their own. And Peggy was one of those people that's just a true caregiver at heart. She loved raising children so much that she also started bringing in foster children, and she helped to raise over 20 foster children, and every one of them had special care needs. She would always find a way to care for them. And she managed to raise all of those kids to young adults, and they began leaving the home. And so Jack and Peggy began to plan for their retirement dream lifestyle. They had talked about all their married life. And they were fortunate. After all those kids were raised, they spent several years on the road in their RV, because that had always been their dream for their retirement dream lifestyle. Except by the time they got there, they were a little older and had some challenges with their health, especially Jack. He had macular degeneration, so all the driving fell on Peggy, but he also began to show signs and symptoms of dementia, which was very hard on Peggy. She had seen many of her friends caring for loved ones with dementia, and so she began to worry about how she needed to care for him on the road. She decided it was just too hard. They sold their little house on wheels, bought a little house in a small town, and Peggy stepped into that role of being a caregiver for her beloved spouse. However, even though she was giving it her all and she was that caregiver at heart, as Jack continued to decline in his dementia symptoms, she began to struggle caring for him. And there wasn't any dementia aware resources in this little town, and her family was all long distance. So Peggy was calling on her family for some emotional support, telling them how hard it was, but she also said she was going to take care of this herself. So her family heard her, that she was exhausted, that this was challenging, but unfortunately, one night, Jack and Peggy were home alone, and Peggy had made Jack a wonderful dinner, as she always did, but as she sat down to have dinner with Jack, Peggy suffered a massive heart attack. Now, Jack's dementia was so far advanced, he didn't recognize that what was happening, that it was an emergency. So he eventually kind of wandered outside, and in his confusion, he said something about how Peggy was tired. She was sleeping on the floor. So by the time help arrived, it was too late.
Oh, that's
Peggy
terrible.
Was gone. And Peggy was my mother. I had to learn the hard way the impact that this has on that family caregiver, especially if it's the same age spouse. And the statistics support this. 68% of the time, if that caregiver does not access help, especially if they are, like I said, that same age spouse, 68% of the time they get sick and pass away first. This is such an arduous, difficult journey, and you must learn to ask for help, learn to care for yourself. And so I discovered the hard way that we all need to raise our dementia awareness in order to provide the kind of care that not just that person who has this dreaded, most horrific disease of our time, any cause of dementia, but for those family caregivers and the professional caregivers, those heroes who go to work and help those family caregivers with this kind of care. So that's what
I do as the internationally renowned dementia whisperer is I teach people how to better manage this, how to connect, how to have tools and strategies, how to provide better, a better standard of care from the resources that we can give. So that is my mission in honor of my mom, who truly was a caregiver hero.
Wow, that's very powerful. And I can see how experiencing something like that would focus your passion and motivate you to write a book and want to help others. So as you mentioned, you are known as the dementia whisperer, which indicates you must be very good at what you do. What are some of the most effective ways that your advice has helped caregivers who are struggling?
Well, one of the basic things about dementia awareness is understanding exactly what dementia is. And we have many myths. We have much misinformation about what that is and how it actually affects people and how it affects, of course, everyone around them. And so one of the most important tools that I can help caregivers of all kinds understand is what exactly dementia is, and then how it affects that person and how we can connect, kind of fill in the dots in their dementia wonderland, support their loss, support their abilities. And really basically the most basic way to say this is that that person has a broken thinker. They're having a very difficult time processing the world around them. So a dementia aware individual learns to help think for them, to keep them in feelings of love, safety, security, and value.
Denny, turning to you now, how did you come to know Laura and make her a part of this lecture series?
Well, my coworker, Erin, when we decided that we had to, because of COVID, we normally have the series live at the library, but because of COVID, we needed to adapt and create an online webinar. It was actually really my coworker, Erin, that did the research and contacted Laura. And I came along kind of later and met Laura. We had a meeting. And the thing that really excites me, Laura, that you said about, I read an interview you did with somebody that we think of trying to stop, fix, or challenge. And basically, it's about like a whisperer, like a horse whisperer. It's about listening and being with that person where they are. And I thought that's such a remarkable shift from the way that we normally deal with people with dementia.
Absolutely, and that's kind of breaking our standard habits of how we communicate with someone with a healthy brain, because what we do with somebody with a healthy brain is we challenge them to think. We challenge them to think about a response to a question. We challenge them to think about a solution to a challenge. And in doing so, we ask them to actually process, to think, to use that part of their brain that they've come to know so well over their lifetime and use all the time. Unfortunately, that very part of the brain is very much affected when someone has a cause of dementia symptoms. And so when we ask them to use it, it causes them to feel anxious. Instead of joining them where they are, joining the feelings that remain, and allowing them to know that we are there with them to get through it, to manage it, and not make them anxious or defensive or resistant by trying to stop it, fix it, or change it, because we can't. There's no cure, there's no recovery, there's no treatment for most of these causes. And there are over 100 different causes of dementia symptoms, by the way, but most of these are permanent and progressive loss. And so coming alongside them and joining them on their dementia journey just helps them to feel loved, safe, secure, and valued. Once again, in the moment, we can't stop them from then a little while later feeling frightened because of this loss, feeling anxiety, feeling frustration, but we can come along with them and help guide them through it. So that's so important. We've learned to come and try and fix this, and it just makes it worse. And that's a hard habit to break.
What's the status of dementia right now? What's the scope of the illness, its effect, and what may be changing as we move forward in time?
Well, it is a silent pandemic. It last I heard, there's over 6 million. Dan, you might have better statistics than I do, but about 6 million in the United States of those that suffer from Alzheimer's disease, which is only one of those 100 causes of dementia symptoms. So you figure that's probably quite a bit more than statistics say. The statistics also say that by the time you reach the age of 65, you have a 50% chance of having some cause of dementia symptoms, which means that 50% of our seniors in this country or around the world do have some cause of dementia symptoms at some level. And I also heard somewhere, and once again, I'm not all that great with numbers, so I'm remembering, but we're in the vicinity, I think, that there are 35 million people suffering from Alzheimer's disease around the world. And it's threatening to triple in the next 10 years. Triple. Wow. And so it is just frightening. And right now on the horizon for most of these causes, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Pick's disease, Lewy body disease, Huntington's disease, we do not have a cure. We have no recovery. There are some treatments. There's, for example, stroke is a cause of dementia symptoms, and there are treatments for stroke so that you don't have, perhaps they can keep you from having another stroke. But once you've had that stroke and have that brain function loss and have those dementia symptoms, they can't replace that loss. So it's permanent loss. And so it's unfortunately, it's not good news. I am just really the grim reaper when it comes to this kind, these kind of statistics. It's scary.
And that must translate to your clientele, Denny. How serious of a problem is it among the folks that you serve?
Well, I was just going to add to some statistics that in Alaska, by 2025, there will be approximately 140,000 people age 60 and over. And Laura, to you, that might not sound like a lot, but in a state where the population's like 700,000 people, that is quite a bit. As a matter of fact, 18 to 20% of all Alaskans are 60 and older. So that means basically one-fifth of our population is 60 and older. And particularly here in Southeast Alaska, we have a really large elderly population. In places like Haines, they have a lot of elderly people in Haines. I was just down in Klawak and Craig over the weekend. There's a lot of elders down there and in the surrounding villages as well. So it's a big issue.
Let's focus on perhaps some better news. What is changing? What innovations or improvement have there been in the field over the last decades or so that it's been studied?
Well, especially around the world, but in the United States as well, there is a standard of care that has been raised. It used to be years and years ago, for example, my grandfather had Alzheimer's, that the treatment was to bind, he was bound to his bed in a skilled nursing community and laid in his own urine for hours. And he was a very proud Victorian from England who just would have been devastated to know that his end days were so awful. There is a better standard of care. It's not your grandmother's idea of a nursing home anymore, or there's in-home care that can be provided so that we can keep them home, which is a great asset to a caregiver's toolbox. If we can keep them in their familiar surroundings, keep them with their spouse or their families, of course, that is always quite a benefit. So care has been raised and because of demand. However, we still have a long way to go. We still look at this as if it's assisted living care, and assisted living care is different than dementia care, even though it can be provided in the same building. Assisted living care or assisted care in their own home is different than dementia care in their own home. And we must have different training, different standards for training. And throughout the community, even for first responders, the entire community needs to have this dementia awareness, because that way we can provide this standard of care, this dementia aware safety net throughout the community in every way that we can provide this kind of support for not just that person with dementia symptoms, but for their caregivers and for their families and for the professionals.
Got it. Well, thank you so much, Laura Wayman and Denny Darby, for being here today and answering all of my questions. I really appreciate the information. I think it's a great preview of the presentation that's coming up this week. So, Denny, where can we sign up if we want to attend? And also, what day and time is this going to be presented?
Okay, so tomorrow from 4 to 5, you can go to our website, www.ccsak.org. You can click on the Caregiver Education Series. You can also go to our Facebook page and watch live. If you can't attend, the webinars are recorded, and you can go to our Facebook page and then click on videos, and you can view last week's webinar.
Perfect. Well, I just want to thank you both again for being here today. This has been a wonderful interview. Very interesting. I learned a lot, and I know our listeners will learn even more if they tune in on Wednesday to your talk, Laura. And so thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Have a great afternoon. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. In the winter months, the Juno Audubon Society offers monthly lectures. As always, they look to the skies. But in this week's lecture, they're looking for birds that light up the night. So joining me now is Steve Kosis, board member of Marie Drake Planetarium. Hi, Steve.
Hi, this is Steve Kosis.
And Brenda Wright, program manager for the Juno Audubon Society. Hello, Brenda.
Hi, Shelley. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much. Thank you to both of you for being here. This is a match made in heaven, or in the heavens, I should say. I love the mashup of stargazing and bird watching. So, Brenda, let's start with you. You're usually out during the day checking out the local birds. Do you do much stargazing at night?
Whenever I get a chance, I truly do love to see those bright lights in the sky. But around here, you know, you got to take your chances.
Did either of you catch that epic aurora the other night?
I was in California, so at 36 degrees latitude, so it wasn't any aurora there.
Ah, how about you, Brenda?
No, unfortunately, the fog came in just as I was keeping my eye out.
Well, there are some great pictures of that. Steve, opposite question for you. How often do you go birding in the light of day?
Well, whenever I'm out, I was out today on the west shore of Menor Hall Lake, and I saw some ravens, which is one of the constellations. Corvus the Raven is one of the nine bird constellations we'll talk about.
Well, this is the time to focus on the stars. The night is long. Brenda, what was the idea behind this month's Juno Audubon Society lecture titled Birds in the Sky, Avian Constellations?
Well, because the Marie Drake Planetarium has this completely wonderful new projector, and the fact that we could actually meet in person for the first time in a very long time, we couldn't pass up the opportunity to see the birds and the stars. Even though we can't see all of the nine constellations from Juno, it'll be really fun to see where they are.
Well, yeah, then that's the advantage of having a planetarium. Steve, how about you? What was your role in putting this together, this presentation?
Well, we have a new digital system, so I used the scripting language that came with it to set up the program for the system. So I push the button, and it'll run and project the images in the database of the Digitalis Lambda Plus system that we've installed.
So which constellations will you be discussing?
Well, you know, there's 50 states in our country. They're all somewhat arbitrary borders. Some are dependent on rivers and mountain ranges. And in the sky, the International Astronomical Union has defined 88 constellations. Some have been thrown out in the past. But of the 88 constellations defined by the International Astronomical Union, which is the same group that threw up the planet Pluto in 2009, there's nine bird constellations. One of them is a mythical bird, the phoenix. Three of those nine are visible here at our latitude, 58 degrees latitude. Corvus the raven, Cygnus the swan, and Aquila the eagle. The other six, you have to go down, probably south of Florida to see the other six.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you can spot raven and eagle from Flinkitani. Brenda, did you learn anything in preparing for this presentation, or were you familiar with these constellations already?
You know, it was interesting. We were having this discussion about the birds in the sky, and I was curious. You know, I read a little bit. I read something in natural history several times about different constellations, and it turns out there was a voyage in the 1500s and where they named a whole bunch of constellations in the southern hemisphere. And while they were doing that, they picked some common things like a dove or a peacock and chose some stars to represent that.
Well, tell me about this presentation. Will both of you be involved in the lecture itself, the presentation itself? I know it's coming up this Thursday. There's two times to go and see it at the Marie Drake Planetarium, but how will you be presenting the constellations and the discussion?
Well, we're going to be very freeform. There is a program show, but we're going to allow interaction with the audience. And, you know, I don't have any real set speech, so I'll be speaking improvisationally on the issue of the constellations that represent birds. And one is mythical, Phoenix. The Phoenix lives about 500 years, and it immolates itself, it burns itself, and the new Phoenix rises from the ashes of the 500-year-old burnt Phoenix. So that's the one mythical bird.
And I'm looking forward to this, especially because of the new equipment. Sorry for interrupting, Shelley.
No, but, go ahead.
And it's always just because the planetarium is such a fun thing to have here in a small town like this. And I just want people to be thinking about other fun things to do in the long darkness. And we're not going to talk a lot about other things except our program, of course, coming up in December and some of the other programs during the rest of the year. But we also want to make sure everybody's aware of the Christmas bird count so they can get ready to sit and watch out their window and tell us about all the best birds that they can see in their own yard.
That's great. Again, the presentation is at Marie Drake Planetarium. It's this Thursday. There is a showing at 6:30 and one at 7:30. It's titled Birds in the Sky, Avian Constellations. What do we need to know if we would like to attend?
Well, the show is going to be through Sign Up Genius, so people have to pre-register for the show, and the registration is on the Juno Audubon Society website, which... Brenda, why don't you say what that is?
Yeah, it's www.juno-audubon-society.org, and it's also on our Facebook page. But please do sign up. The spacing is limited due to COVID rules, and you have to bring your proof of vaccination to be able to get in the door. So please remember to do those two things so that we can fill up the small space that we have available for this great show.
And masks required as well?
Yes. Yes, masks too.
All right. And the Marie Drake Planetarium is located where?
In the Marie Drake building, downtown. That's Glacier Avenue. That big artificial turf field's out in front. It's all fenced in.
Yeah, it's 1415 Glacier Highway. And just remember, you don't go in the door of the Juno High School or the Harborview School. You go in between, like he said, right behind that big turf field. There's another door, and the planetarium is just a few steps from that door.
Wonderful. And while we have a couple of extra minutes, I wanted to ask Steve about the new projector. Tell me a little bit about it. How long have you had it, and what have you done with it so far?
Well, in 1967, a Spitz A3P analog mechanical optical projector was installed, and it actually still works. It's, oh goodness, 54 years old. But about a year ago, we did a fundraising campaign, and we purchased a Digitalis Lambda Plus system from Bremerton, Washington, which was the closest company that had planetarium equipment. And it's all digital, so and it comes with a programming language, so we can program shows, we can do shows real time without the programming, and any kind of digital file we can project. We have facility to use 360 video and 360 images. There's one lens that fills the whole 30-foot dome. It's a fisheye lens. And just the lens itself is a very high optical quality. Just the lens is $10,000, the fisheye lens that projects the images.
And are you pleased with it so far?
Oh, we're very happy. There's five of us on the board, and we do all the work. We're all volunteers, and so we've been learning the system, and we're very excited to present it to the general public. And it's actually the same quality as professional planetariums down south that you'd pay money to go to, and we do all our shows free for the planetarium.
Well, that's so exciting, Steve, and thank you for all the hard work of you and your board members. I know you've been a guest on the show many times over the last few years, and we always have talked about raising the funds for the digital projector, and so now it's finally here. So that's great, great news, and I hope that lots of people will try to come and see the show. I think it sounds like a wonderful collaboration, again, between the Marie Drake Planetarium and the Juno Audubon Society. So thank you both today for being on the show and for telling us all about it.
Thank you, Shelley, and it's on Veterans Day, November 11th.
That's right. Well, thanks, and I hope you have a great time on Thursday.
Thanks, Shelley.
Take care.
Thanks. Later.